A man, a microphone, a video game, a story, and then this podcast. But that's only the half of it. Did the podcast only start because he had access to a mic? Does a story only complement a video game, or are they more connected than what people assume? Friends, welcome to The Pixel Storyteller, the show where we talk about the ins and outs of video games to show you how they're connected to their story. My name is 512, and I hope you all are having a swell day, or night, depending on when you're listening. So, this podcast is meant as a way to see games in a different light. For the most part, most people play games and go, oh, that's cool, then go on with their lives. But every once in a while, there's a game that really makes you think, one that sticks with you for some time, one with a story to tell. But those stories aren't just told in the script and the voice actors. They're told in the world, the music, the gameplay. I'm here today to show you that those types of stories can be found in all sorts of games. So, if you enjoy analyzing stories and want to know more about the world of video games, or if you enjoy playing video games and want to see your favorite games in a new light, you've come to the right place. To get this podcast started, I figured we'd start with the game that got me on this thought process of storytelling through gameplay, BioShock. This game, oh my goodness, when you have a game that is the topic of entire research journals, I feel like it made a good game. To give some background context, BioShock was released on August 21st, 2007 for the Xbox 360 as a first-person shooter, which was more referred to as an FPS game. It was created by Ken Levine and his team at Irrational Games and published by 2K. Now, first-person shooters have been around a long time. It started out with a game called Maze War in 1973. Then, in the early 90s, id Software released Wolfenstein 3D and Doom, which set the standard of for FPS games being level-based games where you use a variety of weapons to mow down enemies. Then, in 1998, Valve released Half-Life, which set the standard of FPS games never taking away control from the player, even during important story events. This is also the year that System Shock 2 was released, which was Ken Levine's first project. Then the 2000s hit, and it was like the British invasion. First-person shooter games were everywhere. To put it lightly, BioShock should have just been swept under the rug as another FPS game. Because 2007, the year it was released, saw the release of Team Fortress 2, Portal, Call of Duty 4, and Halo 3. That last one being one of the most anticipated games of all time. But even once the public demo for BioShock came out, it gained a massive amount of appeal and awe. And a lot of that had to deal with the game's setting, Rapture. To make a long story short, Rapture is a massive underwater Art Deco city built by the game's antagonist, Andrew Ryan, because he wanted to have a city where personal freedom and business was not limited by the laws of any government or religion. But Ken Levine's team really focused on making Rapture a city first, making it not just the setting for BioShock's story, but BioShock's story being one of many in Rapture. But one of the more possible bigger reasons for its success was because of that story. On the surface, it's a simple, guy doesn't want to be where he is right now type of story. But from its writing to its environmental storytelling, BioShock has got to be one of the best stories ever made. And the only way it achieves that is by being a game and letting its gameplay mechanics help tell the story. Now, to fully understand how BioShock's gameplay mechanics play into its story, it'll be best to quickly summarize the story of the game itself. Some of the more in-depth details we'll go over later make sense with the full context of BioShock's story. Oh, and I probably should have mentioned this earlier, but heavy, heavy spoilers ahead. There's no shock value twists in this game. They're all thought out, but still, spoilers ahead. Now, would you kindly take a seat as we begin the story of BioShock? The game opens on a plane flying over the Atlantic Ocean in 1960, and we're immediately in the perspective of the game's main character, Jack. He says a line about how his parents said he was born to do great things while looking at a gift in a half-obscured letter. And that's his only line in the game. That's it. And I realized why afterward. But let's continue for now, because the game immediately cuts to black as the game's title reveals itself to the sound of people screaming. Then immediately, it cuts to Jack swimming his way up out of the water as the wreckage of the plane sinks around him. So after a pleasant swim to a nearby lighthouse in the middle of the ocean, the player makes their way down to the lower level in a weird submarine ball called a bathysphere. And after a quick ad from the game's antagonist, Andrew Ryan, Jack is in rapture. I'm also realizing this now, but Andrew Ryan is literally just a Ayn Rand caricature in a Walt Disney costume. A lot of the game's themes surround themes of objectivism, which is what Ayn Rand was a major believer in. And they both have similar backstories of being Jewish immigrants from Russia during the Russian Revolution, which I just find is a little neat by the developers put in. Anyway, the bathysphere is in the docks, in a station area. And the first thing we see is a man getting killed by a disfigured lady wielding meat hooks before she claws at the bathysphere and runs off. We then get a call from some guy asking us to pick up a radio, and he introduces himself as Atlas.
I'm Atlas, and I aim to keep you alive. Now keep on moving. We're gonna have to get you to higher ground.
In exchange for helping us guide his wife Moira and his son Patrick out of Rapture, Atlas will guide us out of the underwater city. We make our way through the level and Jack finds a red bottle from a vending machine called Adam and takes it. This is essentially what caused Rapture to fall to pieces. Adam has a lot of weird rules and uses in the game, but it essentially boils down to two things. It rewrites the body's genetic code to do things like heal really fast or allow someone to shoot lightning and fire. And if someone takes too much Adam, they become addicted to it, while their face becomes disfigured and they go crazy, which makes up the enemies you fight in the game, Splicers. This is one of the reasons why BioShock stuck out in the game market. Unlike a lot of first-person shooters, BioShock implemented game mechanics from role-playing games, or RPGs, where a massive chunk of the gameplay loop for those games is deciding how you want to go about tackling a certain challenge, and choosing the playstyle that works best for you. After formally meeting Andrew Ryan, the Little Sisters, the Big Daddies, and just getting a general vibe of a Rapture, you make your way to the first real area of the game, the Medical Pavilion. Here you get a new weapon, learn about hacking minigames, and just how insane a lot of the residents of Rapture have gone, thanks to the audio logs left around, and this area's boss, Dr. Steinman, a plastic surgeon who went mad after realizing any changes to the body can be made using Adam. There's one more gameplay feature introduced here, and that's how to get Adam. I briefly mentioned these things called Little Sisters and Big Daddies. Each little sister has a big daddy that protects them as they carry Adam, which allows you to buy upgrades. These big daddies are massive. They hit you like a truck, and you hit them like you just got hit by a truck. They're hard to kill, but are required if you want to get Adam from the little sisters in order to buy different abilities. Before finding the first little sister, you meet a woman named Bridget Tenenbaum. Despite Atlas's warnings, she teaches you how to extract Adam in the little sisters without killing them. Which, by the way, this whole idea of choosing to save the little sisters or just kill them determines what ending you get in the game. We'll talk more about the endings at the end of this, but now's a good time to mention that the multiple endings was an executive choice by 2K, not Ken Levine or his team. Anywho, regardless of what you choose to do, now that you know the general gameplay loop of BioShock, you go on to your next area, which is Neptune's Bounty, the place where all the food from Rapture is. Since we agreed to help Atlas get his family out of Rapture, we make our way to the Smuggler's Den, hidden in a business called Fontaine Fisheries. But before we do that, we have to help a guy named Peach Wilkins, who, in exchange for taking 3 photos of spider splicers, aka that terrifying meat hook enemy that attacked you at the beginning of the game, will let us in. Also in this area, we learn a bit more about why Rapture has gone to ruin, and that's Frank Fontaine. He's the guy who owns the fishery and ran a smuggling ring underneath Rapture. Aside from usual mob boss activities, and since Ryan didn't really like people undercutting why he made Rapture, Ryan goes to war with Fontaine and kills him. But Peach, after getting the photos for him, turns on us because he believes that Fontaine is still alive and that we're one of his new lackeys. After clearing up the misunderstanding, the only way we know how, we get our first weapon upgrade and make our way through to the smuggler's den. While it should be an easy task, Ryan shows up on the radio and sends a bunch of splicers to deal with us and Atlas. Atlas is forced to retreat, and before we can reach it, the sub containing Atlas's wife and son gets blown up by Ryan.
The sub! No!
Devastated by the death of his family, Atlas tells us over the radio to retreat to Arcadia and plan to kill Andrew Ryan once and for all. As we make our way through Arcadia, Ryan believes the only way to stop us is to kill all of Rapture itself and sends a toxic gas into Arcadia, killing every single tree. Since Arcadia is the only forest in Rapture, given its location at the bottom of the ocean, Rapture is thoroughly deprived of its oxygen. So we seek out the help of a Julie Langford, who was conveniently working on something called the Lazarus Vector, which conveniently brings dead trees back to life. Convenient. Surprisingly, she actually agrees to help us, but Ryan kills her before she can gather the ingredients to make the Lazarus Vector, since Ryan claims he owns the Lazarus Vector and can dictate who can and can't make it. So after getting the notes from the late Langford, we make it ourselves and bring back all the trees to life. And now, we head to Fort Frolic, aka the best level in this game. So, before we can head to the next bathysphere that can take us to Ryan, we're cut off from Atlas, and the bathysphere sinks into the water, as an artist by the name of Sander Cohen invites us into Fort Frolic properly. The task he gives us is to kill his former pupils and take their photos so they can be placed in Cohen's new masterpiece. This is one of the biggest levels in the game, or at the very least, it feels like it, because you can kill the pupils in any order you want. And some are genuinely hard to find, since there are so many shops and hidden areas you can check out. Now, I haven't had a good time to bring this up, since it wasn't really relevant until now, but the atom you use in the game is recycled from the dead citizens of Rapture. And since Adam rewrites the genetic code, some of that code stays behind in the atom, which causes us to see ghosts of previous Atom users. One of these ghosts is seen in Fort Frolic. Jasmine Jolene, an exotic dancer at a club in Fort Frolic, and Ryan's former lover, who was killed by the hands of Ryan for her selling something. Well, after killing the pupils and putting their photos in the frame, Cohen reveals himself and congratulates himself for finishing the masterpiece. And since we kinda helped, he gives us an ability and sends us on our way. It's interesting to note that even though Cohen is clearly on the insane side, he doesn't attack you. You can leave Fort Frolic after you finish his quest, and he won't pull anything. I mean, you can attack him and he'll start attacking you, but it's worth pointing out. After getting back into contact with Atlas, we make our way to Hephaestus, God of the Forge and the main power station to Rapture, on top of a massive volcanic fissure under the sea. And let me just say, this is the best area of the game. The overall vibe with the red illuminated water, massive industrial feel, and having to hunt down big daddies to progress gives off the feeling that this is the end, and you're no longer the weak outsider. That last part actually means more, though, on this level, since Ryan is constantly tuning in to figure out who we are. And not in a metaphorical sense. I mean, who exactly are we playing as? A plane crashed in the middle of the Atlantic Sea off the coast of Iceland, right next to the lighthouse you enter Rapture from. That doesn't just happen. Eventually, we make our way into the entryway of Ryan's office as he starts Rapture's self-destruct sequence. We call through a vent to get past a blocked door, and we find an evidence board with Ryan and Jolene and Tenenbaum and three words written boldly in blood. Would you kindly? You pick up a nearby audio log and learn of a horrific scientific study. A toddler only 2 years old yet has the physical physique and mental capabilities of a young adult, thanks to the atom. The scientist in charge tells the experiment to kill a dog, much to the refusal of the experiment, until the science utters that phrase, and the dog is killed without question. We enter Ryan's office, and in a cutscene, he confirms what we're already thinking. There's a reason Jack never spoke a word after the plane crash, because that phrase was written on the gift by our parents, along with a gun to hijack the plane and crash it above Rapture. There's a reason Peach attacked us in Neptune's Bounty, because even though his mind was gone, he recognizes his boss's own tricks. And there's a reason the mission guide arrow telling us where to go disappears in Fort Frolic, because we didn't have Atlas whispering that phrase in our ear.
Would you kindly head to Ryan's office and kill the son?
Jack is the son of Jasmine Jolene and Andrew Ryan. When he was still an embryo, Jolene sold him off to Bridget Tenenbaum, which is why Ryan killed Jolene in Fort Frolic. Jack was then experimented on, being injected with loads of atom, causing him to grow at an incredible rate to be the ultimate weapon. He seemingly, throughout the game, suffers none of the negative aspects of atom used throughout the game, so it's safe to say that he's immune, or at least very resilient, to going crazy. And he can easily be controlled by the simple phrase, would you kindly. After Ryan toys with us for a bit, he hands a golf club to us and gives us the final command from him. Kill. After Ryan goes out on his own terms, Atlas contacts us and tells us to grab the subject self-destruct key. A would you kindly is used to transition us from the cutscene back into gameplay, and you, the player, obeys. After stopping the self-destruct sequence, Adam reveals to us that Fontaine never died. But in fact, Atlas was Fontaine this whole time. And now that the war was over, he calls in drones to kill you, now that his ace in the hole has no more use for him. Lucky for us, a saved little sister shows up and guides us to an air duct, allowing us to escape. Okay, I'm going to pause the story here because, oh my goodness! Oh. Going into this, I was already spoiled that Atlas was Fontaine, but I had no idea that both Jack and us, the player, were being controlled by the would you kindly phrase this whole time. Yeah, in case you missed it, Fontaine wasn't just manipulating Jack, he was manipulating us as well. It's why I stopped using Jack's name and started using more pronouns like you and we and us. I'll get more into the nitty-gritty of it, but this is what a well-thought plot twist looks like. I played through this game again recently to get notes for this, and the amount of times the game hints at the twist feels so painfully obvious now. I don't think I've ever seen a plot twist executed that well in any story, much less a video game. Alright, sorry. Back to the story. Got a little winded there. So, After following the little sister, who was already cured by Tenenbaum, we wake up in the hideout of Tenenbaum herself. Now, depending on whether or not you rescued or harvest little sisters, Tenenbaum's dialogue will change, but no matter what your choice was, she will confirm what was already revealed by the Would You Kindly and Ryan. She tells you that she removed the conditioning from your mind, but Fontaine still has some control over you, and you need to get a special tonic that will remove the conditioning. You make your way through Olympus Heights and Apollo Square, the residential district of Rapture, and ground zero for the Rapture Civil War. After going through the most annoying gameplay section, you get the tonics and free yourself from the control of Fontaine. You make your way to Point Prometheus, the highest point in all of Rapture, to confront Fontaine once and all. But the door can only be opened by a little sister, and the only way to get the little sisters to listen to you is to become a big daddy yourself, and go through Point Prometheus and gather parts for the suit, modifying your vocal cords and gathering the pheromones that let the little sisters know you're not a threat. It's symbolic, it's tense, and it's very frustrating if you grab the helmet first like I did my first time, because it puts a permanent fish lens effect on the screen for the entire rest of the level. But after that, you go through a section where you have to guide and defend a little sister through the rest of Point Prometheus, while she frequently stops to collect Adam from corpses. Old habits die hard, I guess. And after that, you fight one last big daddy in an area that looks suspiciously like the game's box art, and then are given an Adam extracting needle to fight Fontaine with, since in the middle of his constant insults towards you as you guide the little sister, he decides to juice himself up on all the Adam he can find, turning himself into a massive, monstrous splicer. After buying the last ammo you'll need, you make your way to the top of Point Prometheus, the highest point in all of Rapture. And after everything you've been through, the Crash, Atlas, Steinman, Peach, Langford, Cohen, Ryan, it all comes down to this.
You were my ace in the hole, but you were also the closest thing I ever had to a son. And that's why this hurts. Betrayal, kid. Life ain't strictly business.
And it's fairly underwhelming. You dodge his attacks, shoot him until his health reaches zero, drain his Adam 3 times, then a bunch of little sisters show up and drain the rest of the Adam. And if you save the little sisters, then you get a nice little cutscene where you go to the surf together, live normal lives, they get married and start families of their own, and Jack passes away peacefully, free of the chains that bound him to Rapture. And if you kill all of them, Tenenbaum will then narrate how horrible of a person you are, and you start a nuclear Armageddon. And that's about it for Bioshock Story. Sorry, that took a little longer than I thought. But then again, it's important because the mechanics tie so deeply into what make this story great. And I want to put a disclaimer here, because it's obvious that Ken Levine and the rest of the Bioshock team didn't have everything planned out from the start. That cutscene at the very beginning of the game where he's on the plane, that was only added in the last couple months of development. But this isn't a death of the author scenario, because video games don't really suffer for it in most cases. That's the beauty of storytelling through video games, because games are designed with the intention that players can take it apart and explore every inch of it. And whether it was intentional or not, Ken Levine had set up the perfect environment where the theme is laid out, but we get to decide where we find meaning in it. Now, as I mentioned briefly, Bioshock's theme is that of objectivism, or the belief that one's own self has priority over the others and consequences on the choices of others. In other words, you get to make a choice, other people deal with the consequence. And that's most obvious through Andrew Ryan. Like I mentioned earlier, is a reference to Ayn Rand, the founder of Objectivism. Ryan, in his attempt to gain absolute personal freedom, has restricted the freedom of others, and arguably himself, since in Prometheus you can find an audio log where he contemplates whether or not it's his fault that Rapture has fallen apart, but decides he can't question himself while Atlas is still out there. Speaking of Atlas, the consequences of objectivism are shown through Fontaine in his relationship to you. Obviously, this is mostly done through "Would you kindly?" Since every time Atlas says that phrase, the mission objective would appear, and an arrow guiding the player towards where they can complete the objective shows up. And I recently came across my new favorite use of the "Would you kindly?" And it's one most players would have missed. When you make the Lazarus Vector in Arcadia, you have to put it into this machine, and Atlas uses the phrase to tell you to put it into the machine. Except most people would have missed it, because the player would have already put the Lazarus Vector into the machine themselves. Which brings me to my second point of gameplay telling the story in Bioshock: the glow and the flow. When playing Bioshock, key objects you'll have to interact with to progress are covered in a golden sheen. It can be turned off in the options, but it's left on by default, and it's just as controlling as the "Would you kindly?" See, the player gets to the lighthouse that leads to Rapture because of the "Would you kindly?" But the way you enter Rapture is through the bathysphere via a lever. And there's no rush to pull this lever. You can sit in the lighthouse for hours, and the game will give you no sense of urgency. Jack won't say a word, the plane doesn't suddenly explode, the lighthouse doesn't suddenly collapse. The only way into Rapture is if the player is willing and pulls the lever themselves. And not even 15 minutes later, that glow appears again, this time on the first ability you unlock, which allows you to shoot a bolt of lightning. Atlas never utters the phrase. No splicers show up to attack after the tutorial. All there is you, a vending machine, and one step closer to becoming like everyone else in Rapture. Essentially, Bioshock weaponizes the state of flow players are put in using this glow. And there's one more place the glow shows up. Weapons. The glow on these weapons isn't as strong on the mandatory progression items. It's silver, meaning that it's not required to progress. Only the wrench and the research camera are. But every weapon is strategically placed in locations where you would want to use them. And then enemies are strategically placed in places you'd want to use the weapons on. And the game makes you more confident to increase the flow and immersion you have in a game by putting you up against stronger and stronger enemies like the Big Daddies. Now, these Big Daddies I mentioned are hard to kill, but there's already an incentive to go after them. They protect the Little Sisters, which give you Adam. And even after you kill your first Big Daddy in the tutorial, a Big Daddy will be placed with a Little Sister right outside the entrance to Neptune's Bounty, almost incentivizing the player that you just killed one. Why not do it again? And why do you think you can find armor-piercing ammo lying around? Interesting, huh? And headshots deal more damage. And with an upgraded crossbow, a headshot can instantly take out any normal enemy. And what enemies have the biggest heads? Every upgrade, every weapon, every ability, it all leads you to taking out as many Big Daddies as you can find. So when the game asks you to kill at least 3 of them for a mission in Hephaestus, you're already tuned to taking them out, just like every other splicer that Fontaine tricked into a bigger cause because he wanted to rule the ocean. There are also other stories you can find that reflect this control because of other people's choices. You can find... Remember how I said Bioshock's story is just one of many in Rapture? Well, by piecing together the stories over several audio logs, you can find these narratives completely free of the player's influence. A woman by the name of Diane McClintock. A woman stood up by Ryan, injured in the Civil War, convinced to fight for the other side, and killed when Fontaine accidentally revealed his true identity to her. Bill McDonough, a maintenance worker who became Ryan's general contractor and oversaw the construction of Rapture, who decided during the Civil War that the only way to save it would be to kill Ryan. And Dr. Suchong, an annoying and narcissistic man who worked for both Ryan and Fontaine, thinking he got the best of both worlds, killed by a big daddy because he wasn't patient enough to listen to the little sisters he hated so much. And everyone's stories seem the same. The psychopaths, Bill, Diane, Suchong, ours. It can be grim for any hopes of a good ending. I mean, every road leads to Ryan and suffering from the consequences of his choices, right? But there's one more mechanic I failed to talk about, and it's finally time we do. It's finally time to talk about the little sisters. When you save a little sister, instead of choosing to tear the sea slug out of her, you get less Adam. However, for every 3 little sisters you save, Tenenbaum will give you a gift of 300 Adam and some special abilities. It doesn't seem like much. You're just reserving a larger amount of Adam for later, instead of getting more as soon as you kill a little sister. But think about what I just said. You get more Adam by killing a little sister. Think about Adam for a second, because in it, it reveals how you truly interact with the world of Bioshock. Because, spoiler alert, Andrew Ryan and Frank Fontaine are not the real villains of Bioshock. The real villain, at least in my eyes, is Rapture itself. Adam. Really think about Adam. A miracle drug that can cure any illness, make anybody look like anything, give people powers beyond their wildest dreams. Now think about every problem it's caused. Steinman's madness, Peach's fear, Suchong's hubris, Fontaine's desire for control, and Ryan's fear of losing that control. No one in this game lost their choice. They all had a choice. And they chose Rapture. Even sweet, innocent Diane, who decided it was best to throw away her morality and kill a little sister for the Adam to serve the revolution of Rapture. Except not everyone had a choice. The little sisters didn't get to choose to become vessels of hatred. The big daddies didn't get to choose to become walking titans of servitude. Jack never chose to be a slave. And that's why I think this final fight is so fascinating, as lame as it is. You're standing there, a big daddy of your own will, against Fontaine, fully consumed by Adam and transformed to look like one of the many Atlas statues decorating Rapture. And he's finally taken down by the ones he derived choice from. The ones Rapture derived choice from. You and the little sisters. So now, I leave you with the choice. Staring into the reflective amber eyes of the little sister, crying next to the slain Big Daddy. Do you take pity on her? as a servant forced down by rapture yourself? Or do you take the weight of the oceans on your shoulders and take the atom for yourself like so many splicers before? Would you kindly choose for yourself? Friends, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. I was really excited to start out with BioShock, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I'll leave links to where you can buy the game if you didn't heed my warning at the beginning and want to try it out for yourself, as well as some sources I used for this video. Make sure to follow on YouTube for more podcasts, as well as Spotify and Apple Podcasts once I get those set up. And feel free to leave any games you'd want me to analyze and talk about in the future. I have a couple games planned out for the near future, and I'd love to hear what you guys come up with. And with that, I'll leave you on your day. Or night. And I'll see you all next time. Bye!